from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. An estimated 20 million Americans go into psychotherapy every year. Now, therapists and health insurers are battling over what kind of therapy those Americans should get. Extended on-the-couch talk therapy is under the gun. Measurable results are the buzz. And therapists are gunning for each other. Tonight on Point, a psychotherapy showdown. Plus, later in this hour, we'll talk with outgoing New York Times Jerusalem Bureau Chief James Bennett about Ariel Sharon and the future of Israel. But first, we begin tonight in Caracas, Venezuela, where election officials announced early today that President Hugo Chavez won a recall referendum Sunday with 58% of the vote. Opposition leaders have challenged the announced results, claiming large-scale vote rigging. But this afternoon, a team of international election observers, led by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, supported the Chavez victory, saying they had found, quote, no element of fraud. Richard Lapper is Latin America editor for the Financial Times. I asked him if Chavez's opponents and the international community were now accepting the election results.
High-tension day and a high-tension night last night. Still one or two question marks in some people's minds, but I think the fact that Jimmy Carter and Cesar Gaviria, the General Secretary of the OAS, have said their final tallies correspond with those of the Venezuelan electoral authorities is an enormous reassurance for the Venezuelan government and for Hugo Chavez, who survived this referendum, this recall referendum attempt. In terms of the international community coming to terms with this, you know, at this stage, I think it looks pretty set fair for that, actually.
President Carter had a jammed news conference this afternoon where he laid out his view alongside the head of the OAS. What has the opposition there been claiming about the outcome of this referendum?
I think we've yet to hear their full views on this. Very early this morning, opposition leaders were describing the result as gigantic fraud. It had given an identically opposite view, 58-42 victory for Chavez, compared to something of that order that the opposition were expecting in their favor, according to final exit polls last night. And they were actually beginning to celebrate the results towards the end of yesterday evening. So it was a big shock to them to see this reverse. And I think there's a great deal of unhappiness about the pronouncements of Jimmy Carter and Cesar Gaviria. We've seen a little bit of violence this afternoon. I was in a restaurant just near the Altamira Square where there was one or two clashes. We don't know exactly what happened there. Someone was shot, apparently. So there's a bit of tension in the air. There's not been too much violence over this weekend. It's been relatively peaceful. But there is a little bit of uncertainty and a bit of tension, and I think it's going to take some days before matters become clear.
Official results showing 58% of voters going for President Chavez. How are people interpreting this? This is a landslide in American electoral results anyway. How are people interpreting the big turnout, the big showing for the sitting president?
Well, I think people are expecting Hugo Chavez to do reasonably well. You've got to bear in mind that the economy is recovering. The social programs in health and education that Hugo Chavez has introduced really only over the last 18 months have had a tremendously positive impact in some of the poorer barrios of Caracas and other cities. I was talking to people on voting lines yesterday, and there's no question that for many poor people, this is an enormous advance. By the same token, I think that the margin of a victory is a bit surprising, quite honestly. We were expecting a very close race. But the thing that struck me yesterday was the enormous polarization that's still here in Venezuelan society. People had expected 50-50. That's kind of what we were expecting. So it is a bit of a surprise to see this very strong result for Chavez.
And how would you break down the turnout? Is it possible to say, is this the upper and middle class on one side and the underclass, the poor on the other, voting for Hugo Chavez?
Yeah, there are little doubt about that. I mean, the rich, according to one pollster, we haven't seen the final breakdown of the results, of course, nowhere near that yet. According to one pollster, was expecting 98% of the kind of A's and B's, as it were, of Venezuelan society to vote in favor of the opposition, and something like 60% of the D's and E's to vote in favor of Chavez. That's probably what's happened, maybe even a little bit more polarized in favor of Chavez amongst the D's and E's. And I think the majority of, you know, Venezuela's rather small and middle class has probably voted in favor of the opposition as well.
So 2 more years now for Chavez to fill out in his term, if this all continues on this track. And then how much longer might he serve? How much longer is he likely to be leader of Venezuela?
Well, Chavez is a phenomenon, obviously, and it is possible that he will run in the 2006 election and go for another 6-year term. He's threatened in various points. Maybe it's, a little bit of gamesmanship. He's threatened to be here until 2021, which will be the 200th anniversary of Venezuelan independence. I think that sends shivers up the spines of many of his opponents, but there's no question that Chavez is a very ambitious politician. He intends to carry through his program of Bolivarian revolution, which will involve a certain amount of redistribution of wealth in Venezuelan society towards the poor. He could well be around for quite a while.
A huge day for a controversial change agent now with a stamp of approval of Jimmy Carter and the Organization of American States. Richard Lepper, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Richard Lepper is Latin America editor for the Financial Times. He spoke with us from Caracas, Venezuela. Psychotherapy is a significant part of the health care of a sizable chunk of the American population. Over 20 million Americans enter psychotherapy each year for conditions ranging from anxiety to depression to bipolar disorder. Therapy's prevalence is indisputable, but how good is that therapy? Some doctors and insurers are now pushing for more evidence-based therapies over the traditional talk therapy approach of Freud and Carl Jung and more. If a patient can be cured of depression in 10 sessions, they say, it's better for the therapist, the patient, and the HMO. Opponents call it cookbook therapy that runs roughshod over the deep personal interplay of therapist and patient. And therapists are steamed. Tonight on Point, a psychotherapy showdown, what works, what doesn't, and how to prove it. Is HMO pressure for measurable results throwing Sigmund Freud's couch out the window? Is talk therapy dead, or is it essential? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Stanford, California, is David Burns, a psychiatrist who trains residents at Stanford University's School of Medicine. He's the author of The Feeling Good Handbook and 10 Days to Self-Esteem. Good evening and welcome, David Burns.
Oh, good evening. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us. And joining us from Atlanta, Georgia, is Drew Weston, professor of psychology, psychotherapy, and behavioral sciences at Emory University. Good evening and welcome, Drew Weston.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot for being with us. This was news to me, I have to say, but we read recently of this meeting of the American Psychological Association in Honolulu, packed meeting, a big association, and tremendous tension there over a dispute within that world about how to go at psychotherapy, what's measurable, what's not, and what the right approach is. Drew Weston, can you describe for us what's going on? What has people so worked up, as you describe the intensity of acrimony and distaste in the psychotherapy community? What's the issue?
Well, it's really a conflict that's been brewing for some period of time between clinicians on the one hand and researchers on the other. And that's where it started, with the researchers saying, you know, you've got to have measurable outcomes. And a number of clinicians initially saying, well, we're fairly confident what we do works, and eventually saying, okay, we need to have measurable outcomes, but the kind of research you're doing really isn't informing our practice very well.
And when you say clinicians, you mean therapists?
I mean therapists, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers.
And the divide that's come down between, is it correct to describe it as traditional therapy, sort of Freudian on the couch therapy, and cognitive therapy, or a therapy that pushes more quickly and directly sort of life lessons and ways of thinking? Is that the split?
In general, yeah, the on-the-couch piece probably isn't so true anymore. My guess is that probably only about a half a percent of patients who receive traditional psychotherapy are actually on the couch rather than sitting face-to-face with a therapist.
So but it's a metaphorical really, couch these days.
Yeah, it's a metaphorical couch. The difference really is between longer-term, more exploratory therapies and briefer therapies that have made a number of claims for relatively rapid, very impressive efficacy.
David Burns, that's your neck of the woods, measurable and quicker approach. Can you describe the difference between that and more long exploratory therapy?
Well, first of all, you know, I find myself resonating with a lot that Drew is saying, and I'm not sure we can put the conflict here quite in black and white terms. I do think that sometimes the research approaches tend to be kind of a cookbook and trying to force patients into treatment algorithms or treatment manuals, and people are very individual and a good clinician. I spent my career more as a clinician, but also doing research on what are the effective ingredients of psychotherapy, what works and what doesn't, and how can we find out. But I do think that there are powerful new techniques for treating depression and anxiety disorders and panic disorder. And I know if I had a son or daughter who was suffering from depression or any other emotional problem, I would want him or her to be treated with new fast-acting treatments that led to rapid results. Depression is probably the worst form of human suffering, and most of the people I've seen have been interested in going from, you know, horrible despair to joy as rapidly as possible.
And you're saying there are new ways of doing that, and there clearly is the acrimony that Drew Weston talks about here. You told the New York Times, you said, it deeply frosts me, these people who are against measurement and evidence. It's a kind of narcissism in our field to say, I'm so great, I know what I'm doing. You said it puts us back 2,000 years to a time of cults when every snake oil salesman's got something and the parade just goes on. Are you saying that that the traditional talk therapy, that exploratory therapy, is snake oil?
Well, we've got, you know, probably 200, 300, 400, 500, 600 schools of therapy in the United States right now, and they're all competing like cults, like in the Middle Ages when physics was a part of religion, and you had, you know, all of these, you know, religions dominating the thinking of physicists. And when physics and astronomy became a science, fantastic things happened. There was a lot of bloodletting and suffering that occurred when physics tried to break away from the Catholic Church and said that the, you know, Earth goes around the sun and not vice versa. And similarly, I'm looking for the development of a science of human behavior. We use over 50 basic techniques in the training of psychologists and psychiatric residents at Stanford, powerful psychotherapy techniques, but we also ask the residents or clinicians in the community who are coming for training to measure things at every single therapy so we can find out what works and what doesn't work. What is the patient's feeling of how warm and caring the therapist is? And one of the amazing things that we found is that therapists' perceptions of how depressed the patient is or how warm the therapist is are not related in any meaningful way to how the patient sees them.
Actually
and
feels.
So I'm saying that a whole variety of techniques can be useful, but we've got to get into the scientific era and begin measuring things and become accountable and prove that we have effects that techniques that really work rather than just talking to someone, for the rest of their life about, you know, their childhood or their problems in their life. Let's bring about recovery. And there's many, many techniques that can be helpful.
Drew Weston, we've just got a minute before the break, but of course, for a lot of listeners, this is not hypothetical. They're in therapy and they're thinking, well, should I do this for years or is there a shorter way? David Byrne suggests that therapy is becoming a science, and some of that old conversation is simply not with it.
You know, I think there's much that he and I really agree on, where we probably, and I think most importantly, is the importance of measurement and of subjecting psychotherapy to the kind of outcome research that we subject every kind of medical procedure to. Where we would disagree, I think, and maybe be interesting to get to after the break, is the issue of how effective these empirically tested psychotherapies really are. Because we've taken a good look at those data, and on depression, for example, might be a great example to take a look at. I'm not really convinced.
Well, we will come back and look at that. David Byrne, Drew Weston, please stand by. We are talking tonight about a big showdown in the world of psychotherapy that's pitting the old talk therapy camp against a tough new show-me-results mentality, maybe way. You can join our conversation tonight. Is HMO pressure for measurable results throwing Freud's couch out the window? Is defining psychotherapy's best practices, is that reducing it to a cookbook, an instruction manual? Can that capture the singularities of each human mind? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I don't go to therapy to find out if I'm a freak. I go and I find the one and only answer every week. And it's just me and all the memories to follow down.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a psychotherapy showdown between the show-me camp and proponents of more traditional talk therapy. Talk therapy and the perpetual patient and analyst relationship is a popular Woody Allen film subject. In the 1983 mockumentary Zelig, Woody Allen plays a human chameleon who looks and acts like whoever's around him. In this clip, he mimics the doctor treating him, Eudora Nesbitt Fletcher, played by Mia Farrow.
Leonard, you're not a doctor.
No.
No. You're a patient, and I'm the doctor.
Well, I wouldn't tell it to too many people if I were you.
Leonard, you're not a doctor.
Is she going to be all right? Because is this a, you know, I've got to get back to town. Really, I have an interesting case treating two sets of Siamese twins with split personalities, getting paid by eight people.
Woody Allen and Mia Farrow in the 1983 film Zelig. You can join our conversation tonight. Do you want a therapist who follows where your mind goes or who puts you on a defined track for recovery? Is there such a thing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Tony's calling from Nassau County, New York. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Just great, thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, I have gone through therapy for about 3 or 4 years a while ago, and I am familiar with, unfortunately, in our society, the tendency of show me the money. I also understand the importance of measurements, and especially when it comes to paying for treatment for those who can't afford it.
Yep.
And they're searching through HMOs. However, in my experience as one that went through therapy and also as one who's enthusiastic about psychology and probably going to go in the field in the future, is that effective therapy really happens when time is not a matter and it's not a restriction, and when measurements are not exactly defined. Since as someone who's seeking treatment and help, the first thing you want to look for is somebody who treats you as a person and does not have standardized and diagnosis to tell you about, but
so you want it slow, you want it to take its time, you want it to sink in with what's on your mind. That feels like the way to real results. Of course, Tony, you know there's HMO pressure to get things done quickly.
That's true. However, I don't think it would work if it would really work effectively. There may be beneficiary results. However, I don't think that therapy would really work the way I have seen it work for myself if it was something that had to be rushed into.
Tony, let us pick that up, and I'm sorry to rush it, but that's the schedule we're on here a little bit. David Burns, let me put Tony's comment directly to you. He wants to get into a relationship with a therapist and let the talk go where it will to really explore the issue, explore the patient's mind. You're saying, no, let's get this into a defined pattern and get you well, my friend.
Well, I think Tony's really hit the nail on the head. There's no substitute for a warm, compassionate, trusting therapeutic relationship. And you can't rush in and treat people with cookbook approaches without that warmth and connection. Even if you're using the new powerful techniques, say someone has a panic attack and wants to get over panic attacks, so there are new techniques that work, you know, for the most part within 5 sessions, sometimes within in a couple of sessions. But the patient has to confront the monster they fear the most, and unless they have a warm, trusting relationship with the therapist, they're never going to do that. So I think that, you know, there's truth on both sides. Therapy without that warmth, without the compassion, without a motivated patient and a collaboration where two people are working hard together with a lot of mutual respect, it's going to be flat and superficial. You've got to have emotions. You've got to have connections. But on the other hand, you can love your therapist and talk, you know, till you're blue in the face and get all your feelings out and feel understood. But if that therapist doesn't have the powerful new techniques to help you go from point A to point Z and get cured and get over your depression, get over your panic attacks, get over your OCD, then that process can go on and on. So I think, you know, you can kind of have your cake and eat it too. It's not like one way or the other. You've got to have both, and I think that's what Drew, probably what you were driving at too, because, you know, when you talk, Drew, I really resonate with your comments that you can't put people into cookbooks and, you know, force them out the way you would change the oil on a car or treat gonorrhea in an emergency room with a kind of formula. People are more complex. We're all unique. We're all humans. We're all suffering. We need to connect with someone.
And yet, Drew Weston, you can hear that there's, I can hear the real tension here between the kind of let's take our time and explore this approach and David Burns. He says, well, yes, let's have a good connection, but let's go straight to treatment that's going to work effectively and quickly. Does that mean that the old long talk is just that? It's just old-fashioned? That science means quick, direct application of new theories and results and you're done?
Well, one of the unfortunate things is that scientists decided about 20 years ago, scientists who study psychotherapy, that they wouldn't test any therapies that were longer than about 20 sessions. And so we've actually never had the comparison in a controlled trial that we needed between longer-term therapies practiced by experienced clinicians and shorter-term therapies. And what ended up happening with depression, for example, is that researchers went in with the assumption that they could cure depression in 16 sessions. And what they found over time was there's initial period of tremendous enthusiasm where the results looked great. No one got around to studying long-term outcome. And when they started to study the long-term outcome of these treatments, what they found was the good news and the bad news. The good news was that a relatively brief trial, say 16 sessions of cognitive therapy aimed at helping people with habits of thought that are problematic, that are self-defeating, or interpersonal therapy helping people with current problems in their interpersonal lives, were helpful in shortening the duration and intensity of depressive states, which is really important. But at a year and a half out or 2 years out, it turns out those treatments actually are no more effective than a kind doctor dispensing pills. And that's where we run into troubles, where I think that in many respects a lot of the science has become faith in just the same way that a lot of the psychotherapy schools of thought have become faith, that there's this idea that somehow there's this one method which is 16 sessions, put you in a laboratory, and that will tell us what works. But, you know, think about if you had diabetes, or think about, I mean, a great example is if I said to you, I think I can eradicate racism throughout the entire world in 16 easy sessions.
Yeah.
You said, how are you going to do that? Because there's a lot of people who aren't motivated to change their racist beliefs, and there are a lot of people who don't think they're racist, but it shows up in their behavior when they're standing on the subway, a young black man passes, and they check their wallet to make sure.
And getting to the root of that might take longer, you're suggesting, and I guess that's at the heart of all this.
Absolutely. You could easily get – well, now extend it out and think about if the ism is not just towards people who you may not come in contact with that much and see on TV a lot, but the contact – with the ism is towards yourself or towards or emotional reactions towards important people in your life or relationships. Now think about all the complex web of mental associations in the brain that are involved. To think that you could shift that in 16 sessions, I think what you could do with racism is to get people to have some awareness, to get them not to, you know, shout racial epithets. But if you really want to change racist beliefs, I don't think it's going to happen in 16 sessions.
It's going to take a little longer, maybe some more talk for that. Harry's calling from Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Harry. You're on the air.
Okay, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'll keep this brief because I know you've got a lot of people backed up. But when you started off the show by mentioning Woody Allen, I was immediately drawn to his movie Annie Hall, in which he and both he and Diane Keaton are seeing the therapist in that split screen session, which you may remember if you saw the movie.
Right, right.
And it comes out that Woody Allen has been seeing his therapist for something like 15 years. Or something to that effect.
A long time.
At any rate, my thought was, and still is, if he is that disturbed after 15 years, what must he have been like 15 years ago? In other words, it doesn't seem that, at least with him, that the talk therapy for 15 years did much good.
Of course, that's a film caricature, but are you suggesting, Harry, you're afraid that that happens to people in real life? Endless therapy, no result?
Well, I'm
or not
saying
enough.
It does. I'm saying it can.
It clearly can, and we all know stories of when it can.
I have a very good friend who was a clinician in psychotherapy, and when I brought that up to him, he said, well, that's unfortunately too close to the truth.
There you go. Harry, thanks very much for your call. David Burns, that would seem to suggest, let's put the pedal to the metal with something more like your approach. And yet you know how fierce the opposition to some of this has been. Again, the Times quoting doctors calling this instruction manual approach fundamentally insane. I mean, this is pretty tough language within the medical community.
I kind of agree with that, and I think we need more humility and working together. You know, I think this tendency to go into factions and to assume that we have all of the answers is really holding the field back. It's everyone's competing with everybody, and everyone's pretending they know the answer and they've got the best result or the only approach, and that is insane. And treating people with instruction manuals, I think, is very, very simplistic. Drew mentioned the important issue of relapse. There's two goals in therapy. One is feeling better. That's bringing about rapid recovery, within a day or two, if possible, within a week or two. And then there's getting better, which is having the tools to fight off those mood problems for the rest of your life. And I think there is some encouraging research. Just even with my book, Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy, there have been recently seven published outcome studies in psychology journals that 2/3 of patients with major depressions have recovered within 4 weeks, improved dramatically, or recovered just by reading the book with no other treatment.
But, so you're saying, no, you don't need longer-term talk therapy. Yes, the short-term thing can work, it can last.
It can work, and they've done 3-year follow-up studies on those patients who have not relapsed, in that length of time. We have developed powerful relapse prevention techniques that weren't included in those simplistic studies that Drew was referring to. And I think I'm very optimistic about the long-term prognosis, but we've got to be training clinicians in the new techniques.
New and quicker, but of course you heard Drew Weston say he's not convinced that the evidence is quite out there for that long term. In fact, he sees the opposite. I want to bring one more voice.
Well, he's right. I mean, the data, if you look at the outcome studies, it is not impressive. I mean, Drew is a shrewd person here. I agree with what he says.
I've got one more voice I want to bring into this conversation from Farmington, Connecticut. Alex Rodriguez joins us. He's Chief Medical Officer at Magellan Health Services. It's the largest managed behavioral health care company in the country. Alex Rodriguez, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks very much, Mr. Ashwood.
So the paranoia that everybody's got out there is that whatever's going on in healthcare, physical, mental, or whatever, is driven by insurance companies' bottom line. It would seem clear that insurance companies would prefer, in this sort of battle of the therapist, to side with those who say it can be done quickly, in a defined number of sessions, and here's an instruction guide for doing it, and we want to see results and be done. No long-term therapy, please. Is the HMO, is the managed medical world driving this change?
Well, certainly managed care is right in the middle of the debate, but I don't think that this should be an either-or conflict. Good science does strengthen compassion and intuition, and both are really needed to diagnose and treat psychological illness. So managed care, I think, if it leans one way or the other, it's going to lean to where the professions are, that is to say psychiatry, psychology, and social work, and that's towards good science because that's really what patients and their employers or government agencies are really paying for. They're paying for good care based on good science. However, good care also has to be based in some kind of flexibility of interpretation, meaning that individual therapists really are the eyes and the ears of the patient in terms of what they would represent to a managed care organization. So we have to listen to that, and we have to balance essentially the good case that a therapist is making about what a patient needs and how a patient is suffering with clinical professional standards that have been developed over many, many years of professional associations.
But in all this, Drew Weston, I hear again the implication that somehow traditional talk therapy lies outside the realm of good science, as we're hearing it repeatedly tonight.
Well, there has really been, again, a decision by a group of researchers to define what constitutes the only kind of research that will be considered acceptable. If you look at the naturalistic studies of therapies in progress in the community, they all show that longer therapies yield better results in terms of what patients report and in what clinicians report. Just to give an example with cognitive behavioral therapy for bulimia, for example, which is a treatment that can be highly successful, we've used a meta-analytic technique, a technique called meta-analysis, which essentially quantifies across several studies or dozens of studies how well on average the average person the average person is likely to do based on a therapy. And the treatment manual for it that's been tested in all of the studies is 19 sessions. And, my experience is I'm a researcher, but I'm also a part-time psychotherapist.
Right.
And my experience is that in 19 sessions, I can get some bulimic patients to stop binging and purging, but I wouldn't be at all comfortable that that's going to stay that way. certainly not that quickly. And the interesting thing is that when we looked at what experienced cognitive behavioral clinicians in the community are doing, we found that the average length of treatment was not 19 sessions, but it was 69 sessions, which is roughly a year and a half. And that the more personality pathology or the more personality problems the clinician and patient identified, the longer the therapy. And I don't think that's – I mean, there are certainly cases like Woody Allen he was supposed to have his Oedipus complex interpreted to him not to carry it out.
Right.
But, you know, there are certainly cases like that, and I know plenty of them. As someone who is often an advocate of longer-term therapies, there are plenty of cases that go on interminably. Freud actually wrote a paper years ago on analysis that can be interminable. But then you've got the flip side, which is that many people's problems like depression come with a lot of extra baggage. I can't remember the last time a patient came into my office and said, you know, doctor, I've got this awful depression. Everything else is good in my life,
but
I've got this awful depression. And when you meta-analyze the data across all the studies of depression that have been done, what you find is that one of the problems with them that clinicians repeatedly complain about is that we found that roughly two-thirds of patients who are considered to participate in the study are actually excluded from the study because they have quote-unquote comorbid or secondary pathology or other problems that make them impure, and those happen to include things like suicidal thoughts. Well, again, I can't remember the last time I saw someone come in with a major depressive episode who hadn't at least thought about suicide, and that's one of the primary exclusion criteria for virtually all of the studies on major depression that are done.
Alex Rodriguez, we've just got a minute left. Let me ask you this. Is this pressure for shorter term, quicker, more direct results, is it driving class wedge in here? Is it only going to be people who can afford it who will go out and pay for long-term therapy, and everybody else who depends on their insurance will get cognitive therapy quick, to the point, and done?
Well, certainly, class does come in terms of the affordability for care. If payers are only allot a certain amount of money to pay for care, for medical care or for mental health care, then any balance that essentially would have to be picked up by the patient could have some difference based on a person's socioeconomic status or their earning capability. And in that sense, I think maybe there is some sort of subtle pressure to try and speed up the care, because in addition to paying for the skill level of the therapist and for compassion, we are paying for time, and I think that's something that's been recognized for a number of years. I don't think that managed behavioral health care, though, puts exacting pressures on time. What we do is put exacting pressures on the therapist to define that the care is necessary for the patient as well as safe for the patient.
And there's the rub, creating all the friction. We're glad for the insight into it tonight. Alex Rodriguez at Magellan Health Services, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Ashbrook.
And David Burns at Stanford University School of Medicine, author of The Feeling Good Handbook, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Drew Weston at Emory University, thanks so much for coming on tonight.
Thank you.
After the break, outgoing New York Times Jerusalem Bureau Chief James Bennett joins us to discuss Israel's future. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Last month, correspondent James Bennett completed a 3-year stint as Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. His long last piece from Jerusalem, which appeared in yesterday's New York Times Magazine, grew out of a sit-down with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. It offered a profoundly mixed and troubling assessment of the Sharon legacy and Israel's future. James Bennett joins me now from Portland, Maine. James Bennett, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
You were in Israel for an extraordinary 3 years. You went in September in 2001. You were there for the Second Intifada. You've been generous with your time and thoughts with this show throughout that time. And we were really eager to read your final observations on Israel. I have a feeling one way or another we'll be reading more. But let me just go to your ultimate conclusion in this long piece yesterday and ask you to draw the route back to your experience. You describe the potential legacy of Ariel Sharon as being, and I'm quoting, an Israel that is increasingly religious, walled off from its neighbors, simultaneously yearning after and fearing a Western community of nations that sees it as more and more foreign. And you put that legacy right at the the feet of Ariel Sharon. Fill in the connecting tissue for us there, James Bennett.
Well, it took me 8,000 words to do that in the actual story.
Yes,
but The essence of it is Ariel Sharon's determination, really, that Israel always has to keep its fate in its own hands, that it must retain the initiative. With the Palestinian leadership in total disarray, with the Bush administration having put its own peace plan, the roadmap, essentially on the shelf, Ariel Sharon is really the only thing that's moving there, and he's trying to impose or lead the Israeli people to accept his version of what Israel's boundaries should be. And he's doing it in a unilateral basis, that is, without negotiating with the Palestinians. They wouldn't be likely to agree in a negotiation to the kind of boundaries he's seeking to draw. And so as a result, he's trying to do it unilaterally.
Let's pick apart the pieces here and see how you draw them back to Ariel Sharon. Number one, an Israel that is increasingly religious, how do you see that as a Sharon legacy?
Well, it's one of the effects of what's happening now. It's not. I don't think I say in the piece that that's specifically his doing, but it is one of the changes that's occurring in Israel under his watch. He has taken advantage of certainly a lot of the religious zeal of some of the immigrants in dispatching them as settlers into the occupied territories, into the West Bank and Gaza. So he's, in a sense, exploited and taken advantage of it. But I don't think he's responsible for the state's religious character. He's not a religious man himself.
But the settlement movement may be feeding into that. Walled
now, yeah, and it reinforces itself.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, Sharon very much sees himself part of as the sort of original secular Zionist settlement movement. But in the 70s and 80s, that movement was fading out, and he saw religious Jews, ultra-Orthodox Jews, extremely Orthodox Jews who saw the West Bank and Gaza as part of Israel's biblical heritage and had a religious reason for moving there. He saw them as really the new backbone of the settlement movement.
But now, of course, the wall, the fence, the barrier, and you describe them as Israel as literally walled off from its neighbors. You quote an advisor to Ariel Sharon saying, "What we really want is to turn our backs on the Arabs and never deal with them again. We don't want to be accepted into the Middle East anymore." And you describe a turn to the West, but a West that is ambivalent about accepting this fiercer Sharon Israel.
Yeah, that advisor was summing up what he saw as the prevailing Israeli view,
mm-hmm.
not just his own view, although it is his own view, but also what he thinks most of the public feels now, after not only after this conflict, which is now in its fourth year, but also. Because the peace with Egypt has never turned into the kind of warm peace that Israelis dreamed of, that the peace with Jordan hasn't really turned into that kind of peace either. They still don't feel accepted in the region. And as a result, there's this kind of collective turning of the back. And that's where a lot of support for these unilateral measures comes from.
But the warning flare you put up there is that somehow you're seeing Sharon policy as making Israel less welcomed as it faces West as well.
Well, we're seeing Israel is obviously coming under increasing criticism, I think, in the West. It's coming under new pressure from the International Court in The Hague ruled against it on the path of the barrier that it's building in the West Bank. Many Israelis, certainly Ariel Sharon, saw that as purely anti-Semitic. They wondered why the court chose to single out this particular issue to devote so much attention to when there are numerous violations of rights that it doesn't necessarily deal with. But because they're getting so much attention there and in the United Nations, criticism in Europe is on the rise. Israelis are extremely sensitive to that and I think are feeling increasingly isolated.
You spent time with Ariel Sharon and in particular at his farm or ranch in Israel in this interview. And I'm supposing this was given as a courtesy to the New York Times bureau chief as he headed out. How did you find his state of mind, his outlook on the world and his country and neighbors after the Second Intifada and the wall going up and all the rest?
I should say it really wasn't any kind of valedictory interview. It was something I'd been trying to get for months, and it just happened to come through coincidentally then. As some Israelis say, Sharon is Sharon. He's a man who's thought very, very deeply about the issues that most concern him for decades now. He came to conclusions a long time ago about what Israel needed to do to protect itself. He has modified his thinking to some degree over time. But he's a man very, very secure in his own judgment. He's willing to take tremendous political risks and personal risks, I think, to see that judgment through. And in some, what we're seeing now in Israel, disagree with it, if you will, is a real exercise in leadership. I mean, he is trying to take the country in the direction that he feels it needs to go. He's taking substantial risks to do that.
Of course, a major element of that, the withdrawal from Gaza. How do you interpret what he's really all about there? Of course, he was a major proponent of settlement for many years.
Well, in fact, he helped design the original so-called five-finger architecture of the settlements in Gaza to break apart the Palestinian population there. There are now about 7,500 Israeli settlers in Gaza. There are about 1.3 million Palestinians that live there. It's become a kind of running sore for Israelis. A strong majority of Israelis favors getting out of Gaza. Sharon has been a politician now longer than he was a general, and he recognizes that political reality. There's also the demographic problem that many Israelis are increasingly worried about, and even Sharon has begun paying some attention to. That is this argument that within a certain number of years, given the demographic trends, there's going to be a majority of Arabs as opposed to Jews between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, that is, in Israel and its occupied territories. At that point, the argument goes Israel will have to give up either being a democracy or give up its Jewish identity. I happen to think it's much more complicated than that, but it's actually having real political consequences, the fear of this. Withdrawing from Gaza, part of the hope there is that Israel will be seen in the eyes of the world as no longer having any responsibility for these 1.3 million Palestinians. That'll postpone the demographic threat. It also ease substantially, potentially, the military burden on Israel.
You describe a kind of toughening that's gone on in Israel. You say Ariel Sharon's story has become Israel's story and today's Israel. And you write poignantly of there in his farmhouse, you know, lots of personal things around, but two that caught your eye. One, little statuettes of, as I recall, of dancing figures, and the other, a sketch of kind of sorrowful or tired Israeli soldiers on patrol. And you describe the sort of needle of Israeli life moving away from the dancers and toward the patrol, and not just at a literal level, but at some very deep level. What are you getting at there?
Israel is pulled between many, many different poles, I guess you could say. The dream of many Israelis is that their country will simply be like another country, as welcomed as any other country, and that what it will be known for in the world is its contribution to the arts, to the sciences, more for really the life in Tel Aviv than the political issues, than the powerful military, the nuclear weapons, and the constant bickering over territory and Jerusalem. These days, Israelis are obviously much more known for the latter than the former, and the country is much more preoccupied with those sorts of things. Life goes on. Israel continues to produce, obviously, great musicians, athletes, dancers, etc. But military service, including the reserve duty that Israelis have to do into their mid-40s, continues to dominate a lot of their lives. And this fear, the fear that goes with being this tiny Jewish nation on the edge of the Middle East, that fear is enduring as well.
You write that obligation, the commitment, the atmosphere of military readiness that Israelis have felt forced to adopt, though, cuts down on their access to that more creative vision, more normal vision. And you suggest that it conflicts with one of Ariel Sharon's primary future goals, which is sizable immigration to Israel, where he has pretty large vision.
It's a problem. People do continue to immigrate to Israel, but not nearly in the numbers that Sharon speaks of. He hopes to bring in another million Jews to Israel over the next 15 years or so. And at the rate they're going now, that's simply not going to happen. It's it's a problem. It's partly maybe because of our media coverage of the place. We often get complaints that we don't write enough about the other kind of life that one can have there. Mm-hmm. The problem with the official statements made by Israel, which tend to emphasize their feeling that they're victims, that they're subject to these atrocious attacks. It's not, you don't go to the Foreign Ministry website and see an appeal to come stroll our sandy beaches. What you see is a list of victims of terror. And also there's simply the underlying reality. The Israeli economy continues to struggle under the burden of the conflict, and it's simply not an attractive place to move right now.
You write about a deeper trend, maybe related to that, that Ariel Sharon has been concerned with for decades, ever since he made an early visit to the U.K. in the 1950s, as I recall, feeling that Jews in the United Kingdom just couldn't understand the Israeli experience, wanting to bond Jews around the world with the Israeli mission and worldview. Now you quote one of his close advisors saying that Israelis and Jews around the world, to quote this Sharon advisor, he says, we're moving from being brothers to being cousins, and in the next generation we will be distant cousins with some sense of shared history. Is that Sharon's view as well?
No, I don't. I think that Sharon continues to believe that Israel, he continues to believe Israel is a worldwide project. I'm not sure, and this is something people about him say, people near him who followed him closely say, is that he doesn't really understand Jews in the diaspora as well, certainly, as he understands Israeli Jews. The point that advisor was making is that a distinct Israeli identity has emerged. Israelis have a clear national identity, and it's different. It's its own thing. That's something to be proud of. But it can be somewhat alienating to Americans, to Europeans. It's where Sharon likes to think of Jews worldwide as essentially a unified group, although he recognizes that obviously people don't think alike. But what he was very concerned about as early as the 50s is that either the world would make a distinction between Israeli Jews and other types of Jews, or the Jews themselves would make this distinction. And that if that distinction existed, Israel would sort of go off on its own. It would no longer be a worldwide Jewish project. I think, in fact, that is what's starting to happen now, and that's what that advisor was talking about.
That must be a source of pretty significant consternation.
It's a source of worry to a lot of Israelis. It's a long-term trend. I mean, it's something it's hard to gauge. There still are plenty of American missions coming over to Israel, particularly now that things have gotten a lot quieter. There still are Europeans coming there on vacation. It's not like this is happening overnight. But long-term, it's something that does preoccupy a lot of thinkers in Israel.
James Bennett, Israel and you have just made it through a difficult patch of years there. We thank you for your reporting from there and for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
James Bennett. He's been New York Times correspondent, or chief, bureau chief in Jerusalem from September 2001 until last month. And he is headed home. He is home, as you can hear there, on the coast of Maine, looking back to his time with Israel and Ariel Sharon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.